I'm going to start my sermon this morning with a story that I made up. And in this story, there are characters, all of whom I completely made up and are not based on anyone in this church, particularly the chair of the Social Justice Committee, who does not come off great and is in no way based on Randy Earle. However, the congregation in this story I made up, you might just recognize. Let's just go for it. We'll see how it plays out. Bob, this is the man that I have made up, Bob, let's say, was new to the congregation. Bob, a young adult, all of 22, and fresh out of college, where he took religious studies courses and played hacky sack and pondered the meaning of life, has shown up to begin his adult life and speak some truth to power among the flawed and wonderful people of the First Unitarian Universalist Congregation of such and such. And as soon as Bob showed up, Bob joined the Social Justice Committee, because that, he knew, was where all the change happened. That was where he would find his people. That's where he would find those who work to heal the world. And so it was that Bob was there. In the summer of 2008, in a community on the outskirts of an American megalopolis, when the housing bubble burst and good people who came out of the city to find affordable homes found themselves on the other side of what was supposed to be endless prosperity. Subprime mortgages accounted for some 60% of the home loans made over the last decade in the town where the UU Church of such and such was located. And only a mile away, the lowest income neighborhood in town stood with 40% vacancy, abandoned homes growing over in weeds, children picking their way through broken glass on summer afternoons. Houses that went for $200,000 in 2004 were listed at foreclosure rates of under $50,000. Tent cities sprouted up along the highways. People were starting to go hungry to make one more balloon payment on mortgages they would lose anyway. And Bob's UU Church of such and such kicked into action. They worked hard at their food pantry with lines out the door. No questions asked, if you are hungry, we will feed you. They joined other congregations to lobby state and national legislatures. They put pressure on banks for community reinvestment funds. They protested in the streets. They shouted into megaphones. They ran workshops. They listened to homeowners. They made a difference. They were what a church should be. And the Social Justice Committee and the minister were really, really proud of that fact. So in the next Social Justice Committee meeting, they had a rich and full agenda. They made sure that all the volunteer efforts were fully staffed. They made sure the press releases were issued and the split the plate decisions made. And at the end of all their discussions, a leading member of the committee, again not based on a particular person, let's say her name is Babs. Babs let her guard down a bit. She leaned back in her chair with her now cold cup of coffee and said, "I am so grateful that this is my church. I am so grateful that I'm a part of something that really matters. We do everything we can to make differences in this world. We are advocates for those whom people do not hear, and I am grateful every day for this place that helps me do that work. I'm grateful that I'm home here, that this is where my journey has ended. I'm glad I'm not like those fat cat CEO types filling up the evangelical megachurch pews. I'm glad, you know, that we aren't one of those congregations in the middle of the McMansions full of people who work for Citigroup during the week and drive their Bentley to church to hear all about the gospel and get godded up before they head back to their gated communities and lock the doors again. I am so glad I am not like them." And hearing this, Bob, our newcomer to the congregation, having never been on anyone's committee before, without much power in the family system, etc., Bob looked Babs in the eye and said, "You know, when Sunday morning is over, after everybody's left this church and every other one, including those evangelical super fortresses you speak of, somewhere in a gated community in the middle of a McMansion, there will be a fat cat corporate banker on his knees begging for a change of heart. And it's that guy, you know. It's that guy who's going to change the world. We think that we've found this place and we do this good work and we're done. But that guy, the one who's willing to be changed, who asks to have all of his assumptions challenged, it's that guy who will find the way forward, the one who is utterly willing to be transformed right this moment. He's the one. And the meeting ended. And nobody could quite figure out if Bob was completely freaking crazy or absolutely, positively right. What would we do if Bob showed up in our social justice committee meeting? Would you like him? Would you hate him? Would you think he was just flat out wrong or overly combative and not really a UU if he talked like that? Would you invite him over to your house for dinner? Maybe you would. And maybe a destabilizing force like Bob, someone who questions even our most sacred assumptions, someone who tells even we, the good people, that we are not being, that we are not done being changed yet. Maybe a guy like that would be right at home here. I know that some of you would invite him to dinner, and some of you would grow to love him and to be loved by him. Even though every time you turned around, he might be saying something kind of snotty that challenges everything you thought you knew. This guy, this gal, this destabilizing force for change and transformation might just find a home among us, which has a lot to do with why I'm a Unitarian Universalist and why this faith keeps saving me over and over again. The destabilizers, the shatterers of the status quo, the ones who say the world as it is and even our hearts as they are not enough, that we are not done. The people who upend everything we think we understand, at least on paper, they ought to belong here among us. And we, above all others, should be willing and ready to be transformed by the work we do in this world. Here, even the good people come to be changed and to change. And that makes us, if not unique, then at least courageous among religious bodies, because you see, most institutions don't take kindly to destabilizing forces. Most institutions don't take kindly to transformation. This is true for governments, for religious hierarchies, for economic systems, for the political powers that be. Most are so busy being professional about what they do that they dare not risk letting the whole darn thing fall apart so that something new might rise from those ashes. Most institutions don't like people who dig underneath what's working for them. And truthfully, this is also the case for most of our congregations most of the time. Most institutions don't like rabble-rousers. And sometimes institutions go so far as to kill rabble-rousers, not because they're wrong, but because they're making everyone nervous. But we Unitarian Universalists are generally okay with making one another nervous. We at least have a solid base to build upon on that count, which leads me to the question of what is the purpose of a congregation like ours? Why do we exist? Why does this place where rabble-rousers are not tossed out exist in this world? Do we exist so that we might continue unchanging into the far-reaching future with our identity intact and our values unchallenged? Or so that we ourselves might be transformed into fire, or courage, or witness, or something else besides. There are a whole lot of theories about what the purpose of the church or the purpose of religion is. As many of you know, I grew up Catholic, and I am not an unhappy ex-Catholic. I am not a recovering Catholic. I define as a happy ex-Catholic. I've got a lot that I take from that heritage. And one of the things that really shaped me is that I went to a Jesuit school for college. I studied theology at a Jesuit school. And so I have sort of burned into my soul the motto of the Jesuits, which is Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam. Anybody heard that? It means to the greater glory of God. And that motto is, in fact, so important in Jesuit schools that for centuries you had to write AMDG at the top of all of your papers before you submitted them to be graded as a kind of honor code. If you wrote to the greater glory of God on a paper that you totally cheated on, at least you'd feel really bad about it. That was how deeply we lived and felt this motto, to the greater glory of God. When we went to the cafeteria, the words, ad maiorem Dei gloriam, were above the like Sloppy Joe station. So we're eating Sloppy Joes to the greater glory of God. We're learning to the greater glory of God. We're all of it, right? That was what our university was dedicated to. And that's why, at its core, the Jesuits exist. And it's always seemed to me that there are places that exist solely for that purpose. Cathedrals with shining towers, buttresses flying, windows glittering like diamonds, to the greater glory of God. Those places exist for the glorification of all that is holy, to sing praises to heaven and to shout gratitude to such some force that compels such beauty into existence. As historian Henry Adams once said, all the steam in the world cannot, like the Virgin Mary, build shart. So I am glad that such places exist for the glory of all that is holy. I am glad that hands have been built, have been bent to that singular task of forming transcendent beauty out of bricks and mortar and nothingness. A cathedral exists for the greater glory of God. But what about us? The church, the congregation. Years ago, I attended a gathering of young adult clergy from around the country in our first settlement. This big company that had lots of money paid for a bunch of young ministers to come together and think deep thoughts. And we were invited to bring, quote, a picture of our church. And every single one of us, including me, except for one person, showed up with a picture of the building. I was so proud of our building, which, by the way, is one of the prettiest ones. And so we took the pictures of our churches and we put them on the altar as if to say, look how awesome these piles of brick are that we get to serve in. And one of my colleagues walked up there with a picture of a whole bunch of people standing in the middle of a state park smiling and waving. And he said, this is my church. It's not the building, it's the people. So what is the purpose of the congregation? What is the purpose of the church, the people who are here gathered, if not the greater glory of God? What is the purpose of this community we have created? And the story that I made up today, a story inspired by Jesus and the Hebrew prophets and the cranky sages of the Tao, Bob the UU revolutionary dares to tell the good people of the UU church of such and such that they are not done being transformed yet. That the guy up the street on his knees begging for a change of heart has a power we too often overlook. That the willingness to be transformed is itself a prerequisite for the transformation of the world. The purpose of the church, or of faith itself, or of anything labeled under the broad banner of religion at its best, the purpose of it is to cause us to be utterly changed into something closer to our ideals. Or, to use more traditional language, brace yourselves, to make this world a little closer to the kingdom of God. I contend that we must approach the religious life and the life of our congregations willing to be transformed, because no matter how good we think we are not done yet. The purpose of a congregation of faith is to transform. And the purpose of every story Jesus told and most everything Buddha pondered is the same, to shake loose the assumptions of our listeners so that they might in turn shake up the powers and principalities that dominate this world. And sometimes I think we forget that in our congregations. We get lost in thinking that the purpose of the church is any number of things besides transformation of souls and the transformation of the world. As a liberal religious people, a body dedicated to transformation, our purpose is not to be cool. It is not to be a fun place for liberals to hang out with other liberals. It is not even to learn stuff and fill our heads with a whole lot more information. The purpose of this whole grand experiment is to be transformed and to transform. And in order to do that, we have to challenge ourselves to admit that what is of this world and what is even of ourselves isn't finished yet. This week, I was in a meeting of social justice leaders with Voice, this community organizing group that we're a part of, which, by the way, is fabulous, and you should really get involved. I love it. Anyway, I was in this meeting, and we were talking about the dominant narratives that we carry in our congregations in Northern Virginia, the stories we tell about the places we live. And my colleague Linda Olson-Peebles told us that the dominant narrative of the city of Arlington is, in terms of social justice, that we've pretty much got that all sorted out, don't we? She said that the dominant narrative of this wealthy county with liberal folks is that taxes support county services and public schools are good, done and done. We're in good shape, right? That's what people think about that city. But as Linda said, I have walked in the woods with the homeless people in Arlington County. We have seen that things aren't all good. We know there is work to be done, and we have got to tell a different story. No matter how much we want to believe that even we enlightened ones are all done growing and changing, the simple fact is that there is work left for us to do. We are not done yet. In the words of David Rankin, always the roots need to be exposed. Always the chains need to be broken. Always the rulers need to be shaken. We can and must do 1,000 things to bring about change. Guided by the experience and wisdom of our history, we can work, we can speak, we can protest, we can be imprisoned for justice, and we can set others free. We can pack a gun or a feather or a grain of salt as our weapons. We can be angry and we can be gentle. We can give food and we can receive care. But before any of that happens, we have to show up to the doors of our sanctuary ready to be changed ourselves. We have to arrive with nothing less bold than the intention of altering everything we have ever known and picking up something new. And when I have preached such things as this before, because I have, you have asked me really good questions. After all, we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, every one of us, no matter what, and many of us, including me, find our way here because 1,000 other people and places have told us time and time again that we are not enough, that we are broken, and that we do not belong. And so the questions naturally arise. Sure, transformation worth pondering, but aren't we here to love one another and to be loved just as we are? Yes. Aren't we enough just as we are? No. Can't you love me for who I am? Yes. With all my heart and with all my soul, yes. But we should love one another enough to see not only blessed and beautiful people endowed with great gifts, but blessed and beautiful people endowed with great potential, not all of which has been realized in this life. As long as I have one more day, I want to learn something new. As long as there is a breath yet to breathe, I want to be open to transformation and challenge. And there is no place in all the world better or more perfectly suited for that work than this place, where we are loved and we are safe and we are celebrated no matter what, every single day. So come, guided by love and willing to change. Let's walk together for a while. And let's not be surprised when what we think we know turns out to be only the beginning. When who we think we are is just an unfolding truth. And when we find ourselves drawn toward a version of ourselves that we have not even begun to imagine yet. May it be so, and amen.